And joining me in the KRVS studios, physically distanced by telephone, is writer John McNally. He is the UL Writer in Residence. He is a graduate of the Iowa Writers Workshop, and here at UL, he is also the Dr. Doris Merriweather and Board of Regents Professor in English in the English Department. So we're just so happy that you're here on our campus. I know that, you know, I've heard many good things from students who have had you. You also have an amazing, prolific publishing record. You've published quite a bit of fiction. You've also published a lot of books on how to write. And you are the writer in residence, so you do work with students to write. But you published quite a few of them, and that's that certainly must be a special talent to be able to convey that. So that's a great credit to you as well that you've published so many of those. Some of your previous books include The Book of Ralph, a novel, and also The Boy Who Really, Really Wanted to Have Sex, the memoir of a fat kid. And the book you're here to talk about today is a short story collection, The Fear of Everything, that will be published. It will come out on September 1st. It's being published by the UL Lafayette Press. So we're very proud of the press and glad that you chose them to publish your stories. I have a copy here, an advanced copy, and it's really a lovely book. So thanks for taking a moment in your schedule to talk with us today. Now, I know you were.
Thanks so much for having me.
Yeah, well, it was a delight having you in our studios a few years ago. You were here talking about, and I think we figured it out, it was The Book of Ralph, but the young adult version of that.
Right.
Yeah. And so tell us just a bit about your background. I know I mentioned the Iowa Writers Workshop, which is very prestigious. What were you always a storyteller? Did you always like doodle and sketch out stories, or were you the person in your class who just kept people entertained with stories for hours?
I think I was a pathologically shy kid, so I wasn't regaling students with stories. As early as fourth grade, I had a teacher who gave us a creative writing assignment, and we had to write a play and also perform it. And it went over well with the teacher and with the students. And so that was kind of like my first hint, I think, of thinking, oh, this is something that appeals to me and something that I enjoy doing. Later, I realized also that my mother grew up in a sharecropping family in the South, and she just had these wonderful, wonderful stories. And she was a great oral storyteller. She had dropped out of school in eighth grade, and I think had a kind of an inferiority complex about that. And it was after she died fairly youngish, and so it was after she died that I was finishing my MFA and then began to teach. That I realized just how intuitively good of a storyteller that she was, and just incredibly insightful and knew how to pace telling a story. So I just think like growing up in that environment was something that you know, through a kind of osmosis that I ended up absorbing.
Mm. What kind of stories did she tell? Did she talk about her family or folklore stories?
They were personal stories about growing up and stories about her family. But there was also something very gothic, Southern Gothic about them too. Mm-hmm. So, you know, some that seemed, I mean, the thing that was great about my mother's storytelling as opposed to my father's storytelling, my mother's storytelling could, you know, the actual story could defy reality in some ways. I mean, some stories that I kind of vaguely remember her telling, where I would think like, oh, it doesn't seem like it could happen. But she was such a good storyteller that I never questioned it at the time. And I was just kind of sucked into the story. My father, on the other hand, was just, obviously would just exaggerate for effect.
Two great Southern traditions.
Well, my father was from Maine.
Oh, okay.
But I could always tell that he was making things up on the fly. They weren't credible stories. Whereas my mother, I would ask her to tell me stories that she had already told me because they were so entertaining and so interesting.
Well, and when you say Gothic, of course, I'm sure many people listening going, oh, yeah, Flannery O'Connor, which is who people always turn to. But, I mean, there is that element where you're not surprised by anything that people encounter in these stories. There's really no exaggeration. It's just someone telling a story with really unusual people and really unusual circumstances. And you accept it all. You take it in. You're not disturbed by the exaggeration of it. So when did you, I mean, you mentioned the thing in fourth grade, but telling a story orally is a little different than writing it down for other people to read it. Did you actually write down some of her stories, or were you just inspired by the style of how you describe she would tell these stories?
I think it was just more intuitively, mm-hmm. like her sense of pacing and her sense of timing and the kinds of stories she told. But it really wasn't until I was in college and I took my first creative writing class that I began thinking about the possibility of doing this seriously. Mm-hmm. I grew up in a working class family and I didn't know any writers growing up. And so I didn't know what writers did other than write books. I didn't know that writers taught oftentimes. So it wasn't until I took a poetry writing class with Rodney Jones at Southern Illinois University that I was like, oh, okay, this is what writers do. I mean, they teach, and then I, you know, was able to kind of talk to him about process, and so that was really my first exposure to. I mean, I'd written stories before that, but I actually hadn't read that much. I didn't come from that kind of background. I read Mad Magazine. I read, you know, like things like that. So he began giving me lists of people he thought I should read. So that was really kind of my first exposure to literary fiction and literary magazines and that whole world.
Mm-hmm. Well, I'm glad you mentioned that, because one of the great things about having your stories published in a book like that is that so many more of us can enjoy them. Many stories, like what you're describing, are published in literary magazines, and those are not always readily available to a general reading population. So that's really wonderful that the UL Press and other presses like that will gather them together and make them more available to us. So when you started, after that experience, how did you start shaping your characters? What kind of characters were you drawn to create in your stories? They're very, we mentioned, we were talking a little bit earlier about them, and I said I was moved to follow their stories. Nothing, I want to read a quote that years ago Richard Russo wrote about one of your early books. John McNally is an electrifying writer whose stories burrow under the skin. His world becomes our world, his way of seeing ours. Resistance is futile. Now, I know that's, you know, everybody knows that phrase, but I had no resistance. I had no resistance to your characters. I just followed them. And that was a marvelous feeling in a story. So I guess what I'm asking is, when you started thinking about shaping these characters, what did you want them to be like? How did you imagine? I mean, and they're all different. They're old people, young people, but something about them just draws you.
Well, I mean, for a couple of things I always talk to my students about. One is, I had a teacher who once said, you know, I mean, the cliche in creative writing is what's at stake for the character, but he said, what's at stake for you? To one of the writers in class. And so for me, that's kind of a central question, which is always, what's at stake for me in this particular story? But you're also always not conscious of what's at stake for you in writing a story as you're writing it. But I do feel that if you burrow enough, and I think the word burrow is an interesting word to use, because the other thing I always tell my students is, it's like, if you can burrow like deeply enough into the consciousness of the narrator that you're writing about, you're likely to tap into those kinds of things in your own life in which you're putting something of yourself at risk, even if you're not entirely aware, because you're tapping into your unconscious mind. So for me, when I begin writing stories, they're often mysteries to me because I don't know the direction the story's going to take. But I begin seeing patterns as I'm writing stories, or I begin seeing bits and pieces of myself, and especially when I revise. You know, I was telling you beforehand that this book took 10 years. I put stories aside for a number of years, and then I go back, and you know, at that point, then I could have a little bit more, not just objectivity about the story itself, but objectivity about what were some of my own obsessions at that particular time when I was working on those stories. And by having that objectivity, then I can go in and revise the story so that, because I have a better understanding of what the story is. So for me, it's this kind of weird Frankenstein-like fusion of having a character that's not me, but then giving them my consciousness or my subconscious in a way that creates this like a doppelganger.
That's a wonderful description of that, and I think people can understand why you're a great teacher. And I think that must be of comfort to your students too, to realize that, you know, they don't have to be so driven that they're just churning out stories, you know, week after week, ready for publication, that it is an evolution and a process that can take many years, I would think.
Yeah, I my last book was The Promise of Failure, which is about, you know, hopefully it's a more uplifting book than the title suggests, but it's really about the idea that you're on this lifelong continuum when you're writing, and that, you know, there are projects of mine that I considered to be a failure at a particular time, but 20, 25 years later, I ended up writing that story without realizing I was writing that story. That, you know, nothing is really wasted. It's all there. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, for me, it's, you know, the story that took the longest, and this was the last story in the book that I began writing in 2007 and finished in 2017. Mm-hmm. I just took it to a certain point and couldn't figure out where to push it, and then came back and revisited it later. And I had changed, and so the story had evolved in its own, I guess, like during its gestation, its 10-year gestation period. And I was able to kind of go in then and see what it needed.
Hmm. Well, as you're describing your process, I'm kind of beginning to understand why I felt the way about some of your characters, because it felt so human, because you allowed them to become, you allowed them to evolve. I never felt forced into a character. I felt like they were completely natural, and that they were quite human. It was just a lovely experience. And I think people, as they're listening to you, also realize there's an element of humor in the way, not comedy, but there's one reviewer wrote about the big-hearted quality of your writing. And there seems to be that element in your stories where it's, how can I describe that? Some short stories I read, I feel like there is no redemption. I have no empathy for any of the characters, and I find myself angry at the writer by the end because nobody's redeemed, nothing good happens. And even though there's a lot of horror and seeming failure in your stories, I never feel like you're condemning your characters to that. That they are always somehow, it's okay. It's okay, no matter where they end up. I mean, am I far off on that, or just?
No, I'm a big advocate of redemption. As far as, you know, I have great empathy for the characters as I'm writing them.
Yes.
Otherwise, mm-hmm. I wouldn't be able to write about them. Mm-hmm. I wouldn't be able to get inside their head. Mm-hmm. I want the best for them, even if things are going horribly wrong in their lives. But they have to come out of it. I mean, for me, for the story to work, that there has to be some kind of evolution in their life.
Yeah. There's a great line in one of the blurbs in front. And I love the blurbs, too. I mean, that's a credit to you also, because some blurbs are just unbearable. But these were obviously incredibly attentive to your work, and you could tell that they had read them and really enjoyed them. And I guess Pete Fromm says he can make you laugh all the way to the heartbreak. That was such a wonderful, and even maybe you're not laughing, but I'm empathizing all the way to the heartbreak. I'm there with that character all the way to the heartbreak. And that's no small gift, John McNally, to do that with your characters. And I do want to tell people who may be tuning in that my guest is the writer in residence here at UL Lafayette, Professor John McNally. His new book, The Fear of Everything, a collection of short stories, is being published by the UL Lafayette Press, and it will be out available September 1st. There are 9 stories in here, and there are a range of characters, and there's an art in that too, I'm sure, choosing the stories that go into a collection like this. The title is the title of one of the stories, The Fear of Everything. Can you tell us just a bit about that story and why you chose that title to name the entire collection?
Yeah, so that story, I think probably just in terms of what that character is going through was, even though it's not what I went through, it's similar, it's more closely aligned with my life than some of the other stories, in the sense it's a character who's trying to reinvent himself in his 50s. And he's experienced something bad, and he's trying to move on from it. And I think when I began working on most of these stories, I was going through a divorce. My father had just died. I was moving 900 miles from North Carolina to Louisiana. So I had taken a new job. So I had all of these kind of new things happening in my life, and people who were in my life who were no longer in my life. So I was trying to tap into that for that particular story. But as far as the title, The Fear of Everything, I try to find titles for short story collections that in some way works for the tone of the the tone of the book as a whole. Mm-hmm. And I felt like in this particular book, I tried to do things that I hadn't done before. So there are fantastical elements in some stories. There are historical elements in other stories. But I also feel like there's a little sense of dread or menace that I hadn't tapped into earlier in some of my earlier books, that in this book I was playing with that. I didn't realize that that's what I was doing until it's hard to see until I get about 4 or 5 stories into a book, that there's something slightly ominous in this book that I hadn't dealt with before. So the title for me felt like it could also work as the title of the book.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, when you say that, I'm just thinking, you know, feeling my way back through the stories, and everybody, there is a fear of something in all of the stories, but sometimes it's clear and sometimes it's not, often more ominous as you describe it. But that, again, that's not the full description of it, because if you were completely surrounded by fear in every story and there was no way through, no redemption, it would become unbearable. But there is nothing ultimately unbearable about these stories. How would you describe what happens to your characters, even though they're fearful, even though there's something they all fear, whether it's the past or a parent or an ex-wife or something, a photograph? It's not unbearable. Something, what are you working towards in these stories that makes that possible, that gives us that feeling?
That's a good question. I do think maybe this is also just part of getting older. I have more hope than I did probably in my 20s. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. I mean, I feel like the older I get, the more it's like you can't, you know, it's harder not to have some hope, even though, even as the world just kind of crumbling around you. I mean, it takes more hope to kind of just to push ahead. And so I do feel like, I mean, maybe going back to the idea of empathizing with the characters, that I don't, yeah, I mean, I want there to be this kind of, I don't want to say like a lift at the end.
No,
it's
it's
like,
not that.
It's not a beat, you know, but I like that possibility that there's, that something positive might be in the character's future.
Well, I know there's also a blurb from, I guess, an interview you did with NPR, and or they're talking about the book, and they say that, you know, if you can't find love, at least you can embrace the grief. There feels like there's an embracing of something in each story. So, yes, it's not really an upbeat, but it is something where I get to the end and I don't feel terrible. I don't feel damnation. I don't feel condemnation. There is a, you can breathe at the end of each story.
I mean, I think one of the things, I guess in terms of, I was trying to think of like how to describe what I mean by lift. Mm-hmm. So one of the things I try for endings of stories is that, I mean, since stories are, since when I write the story, a lot of it is coming from my unconscious mind. Mm-hmm. So what happens is that there are all these kind of mysterious details and mysterious things that happen as I'm writing it. Things I didn't plan. And what I want is I want all of that to have some sort of logical sense by the end of the story. And so I'm trying to push stories to have a kind of a collective, I don't know, like a sense of transcendence just by the kind of the weight of all of the things that had come before, so that the reader gets to it and maybe, you know, it's like, I don't necessarily want the reader to, you know, I don't want the reader to come away and say, oh, this is the meaning of that particular story, but I want them to feel something.
Yes.
Yeah. And I think that that's what I'm trying to push them toward. And that's what I want. That's what I mean by transcendence, which is that I want them to have a kind of collective sense of what the story, you know, what it means on an emotional level.
Well, let's talk about a couple more. We mentioned The Fear of Everything. It's one of the stories in here, and it's the title of your collection. But they're all each so unique and so surprising in their own ways. And you get that every single one of them, the first sentence had me going, I'm in. I'm going into this story. You have a wonderful touch with those first lines and first paragraphs. I guess the story that... I love so many of them. The phone call is one of the most surprising in the book, I think. Can you describe that story for us?
Yeah. Well, I'll tell you the kind of origin of that story, which is that probably in 1988, after my mother died. My mother died in, well, she died in 1988, so it was probably in 1989. I was 23, and I stayed up one night. Where I wrote a story in one draft, which is almost never happens for me. And it was a story called The Phone Call. And then I put it aside, and then a couple days later I looked for it and I couldn't find it. I'd lost it. And it was a very cathartic story and it was also unlike anything I'd written because it had this kind of fantastical element in it. But I had no idea what had happened with it, with the story. So flash forward to 2010, I think. A friend of mine was editing an anthology of short stories that were inspired by Ray Bradbury. He was Ray Bradbury's official biographer, and he was friends with Ray Bradbury. So he invited me to contribute a story, and the anthology was going to have stories by... Margaret Atwood and Neil Gaiman and all these big people. So I said, of course, you know, of course I want to be in that book. But then I began, I was thinking, well, this is, I don't really write these kinds of stories, so I don't know what I'm going to do. But Ray Bradbury was somebody who I read, one of the few writers I read when I was a child. And so I went back and I began reading Ray Bradbury's stories. And I thought, oh, well, you know, there was that idea of a story that I had written back in 1989 that had kind of haunted me for all these years. What if I try to write that story? I'm trying to think of how to describe the story without giving it away.
Right. But now that you say Ray Bradbury, absolutely there is a sense of that, you know, odd, not science fiction. This isn't that, but it's
a little Twilight Zone-ish.
A little Twilight, you know? Yes, exactly.
And so, yeah, and I think like,
well, and you don't want to give it away. I would love everybody to read this story. It has to do with a very strange phone bill, and
hello.
Yes, it's a very strange phone bill, and what people conversations that he has that he's very uncertain about. But it's lovely. It's just and congratulations on having it printed in that anthology. That's marvelous.
Well, what was interesting was that I found, it was when I was moving here, a couple of years after the anthology came out, that I was packing up my things, and I found that story that I'd lost in 1989, and read it, and was surprised at how similar it was to the story I wrote 20-something years later.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Well, that's like something out of one of your stories.
Yeah, and it was also, but that was the story that kind of solidified for me mm-hmm. what the tone of the book should be,
mm-hmm.
which was this kind of, I don't want to say like the book is Ray Bradbury-esque, but when you read a Ray Bradbury collection, you realize that he wasn't just a science fiction writer. Right. He had all these different kinds of stories, mm-hmm. and different tones of different genres.
Well, and he is one that, like you were saying, you have this goal of this people having this collective emotional response to your stories, not necessarily having a meaning, but an emotional feeling. And isn't one of the Ray Bradbury stories about and spring rains shall come, or where the house is the only, there are no people left in the house, but every morning it wakes up, the house wakes up, and all of the appliances work. You know, there's been an apocalypse, and I still think about that story. It stays with you, that emotional feeling at the end of the story. So a nice company to be with, Ray Bradbury. And we did talk earlier before we went on air about a story that I really liked, and it's a little different than the others. It's a bit historical. It's called The Devil in Details, but yet it has that emotional resonance as well at the end. And I, when I mentioned that your sentences that start off the story stay with you, I loved this sentence. It starts off, it was the last thing on Mary Flynn's mind when she crawled into bed that night, but by the time she closed her eyes for sleep, the overwhelming lure of sin had wrapped itself around her neck as comforting as a scarf. That sounds very Southern. how did this story come about? Again, it's one that, you know, you don't want to give it away, but I would love people to read this story.
So I spent years writing a historical novel about the Chicago Fire, and I couldn't get it to work. I was probably like 10 years of my life working on this book, and I just couldn't get it to work. And when I set it aside for about 5 years and went back to look at it, I realized why it didn't work. I just stuffed it with so many different things. But one of the things that I had was a backstory about this character named Mary when she was a child. And the book that I had was just, and the book I'd written was just full of all backstories for every character and all this historical stuff. And, that was the one thing that I thought, like, it was kind of divided up throughout the book. And it was about her growing up in this small Southern Illinois town that that I lived in briefly. And I thought, well, I wonder if that could be a story. So the process for that story is a little different than the other stories.
Mm-hmm.
I took it out of the novel and pieced it together, and then began looking at it and filling in gaps and starting it from the beginning and rewriting it. So it was a, it was a, it was, I don't think I've ever done that with any other, story. And I think maybe that's why, I mean, beforehand I was saying I wasn't sure whether to even include it in the book or not. I think maybe because the process for it was so different for me too, that I didn't write it as a story. I had written it as a backstory. And then I pulled it out and tried to figure out how to make it a story. But it's, yeah, I mean, it takes place right before the Civil War. But the town that I was basing it on is Benton, Illinois. And Benton had the last public hanging in Illinois in probably the 1930s. But I think, like, when I was just reading about kind of the history of Benton, and that's what was, I mean, Southern, I lived off and on in different places in Southern Illinois. And Southern Illinois just had this kind of odd history of being, I mean, it's a northern state, but Southern Illinois felt very much, felt more southern than some southern places I've lived. So it was, you know, I think there was this, always this kind of tension in terms of, like, is it a northern state? Is it a southern state? And I wanted to kind of play with that in the story, too.
You really get that feeling. There is something very southern about these characters. And I think there was a lot of immigration from the South and Appalachia into those, that part of Illinois. And it's also from the point of view of the little girl, Mary. She's quite young when you start the story. And there's a lot about, well, you really talk a lot about sin and redemption in this story. And it's, it has a very emotional feeling at the end. You're really not certain what happens there. You don't have a sense of a meaning or something wrapping up, but a lot of emotion in the story. Really lovely. I do want to tell people again, if you are tuning in, finding yourself fascinated by the stories, this is a collection called The Fear of Everything by John McNally. He is the writer in residence here at UL Lafayette. His book is published by the UL Lafayette Press, available from September on. And you can read more about it at the UL Press website, I believe. So we appreciate you taking time to be with us today. So you're pleased with how the group of stories came out and the publication. I mentioned to you earlier that it's really a beautiful publication, and it's one I enjoy holding in my hands, which you think shouldn't matter, but it is a package, you know, it's a total package. And they did a great job, I think, along with your help, too, in the publication. So are you pleased with it?
Oh yeah, absolutely. Yeah, it's as I was talking to you a little bit beforehand, that I had hands-on involvement with the production of it. So I'm pleased with how it turned out. I got to worked with the guy who did the cover art. It's also a fiction writer, and so and he did this drawing of me that's on the back. Which also is a slightly menacing version of me. It doesn't really look, I'm not sure that, I mean, it kind of looks like me. It's a little bit of a doppelganger. So it works for me. And I like the fact that his hat says Doom.
Doom.
But yeah, so I'm happy with the production of the book.
Yeah. And even
which to me is something that draws me. I mean, as a kid, I used to buy Scholastic books all the time, so I've always been just a book lover. Even if I wasn't reading books, I would be holding them and looking at them as products. So it's important to me how a book looks, and I really like this one.
Yeah, when you mentioned Scholastic books, I'm sure there's quite a portion of our population whose heart just went, oh, I remember that. I love that too.
Well, I would get things like the like a book on Houdini or something like that. I mean, there's all these, I probably still have those somewhere.
Yes. I think I got that book
too. The Loch Ness Monster, right? A book on the Loch Ness Monster.
That's right. Well, I don't know if any of these would show up on the Scholastic list for middle schoolers, but.
No, I don't think so.
So again, the UL Press, you can find out more there. I think some people might have a question about whether or not living in Louisiana has informed any fiction you're writing right now. You mentioned many of these stories were written as you were leaving where you were before and transitioning in your life. How has living in Louisiana, at least part-time, affected your writing, if at all?
Usually it takes me a while after I've left a place for it to affect me. So I don't know. Mm-hmm. It's hard for me to say right now.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
I know that there are characters in the book that have been, you know, I wouldn't say that they're not based on people I know, but they were inspired by a few people that I've met. So the people begin kind of creeping in, but the place itself hasn't crept in yet.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
But I'm finding things I'm working on now, like other, I'm having characters whose backgrounds have some connection with Louisiana. But it's hard for me sometimes to process a place while I'm still mm-hmm. actually living in the place.
It's interesting that you say that. There was a writer in residence here. Well, she was a poet in residence, Cheryl St. Germain, and from New Orleans, very much from Louisiana, but really didn't start writing about it until she became writer in residence in Illinois. So, you're right. That does take time to filter through. So are you with your students here at the university? Of course, the writing program here attracts people from all over the country. But I'm sure you do encounter students from Louisiana. How do you find, you talked about your mother being a great storyteller. Is there something about students here and their stories, or do you encounter an interesting perspective among students here?
Most of my students, I'm working mostly with PhD students,
right.
And most
yeah.
mm-hmm. are not from Louisiana.
Right.
So although I've had some undergraduate students in my classes who've been from Louisiana, it's hard for me to make a generalization about that, I think, and I don't know.
Mm-hmm.
I know that I meet a lot of people from this area, mm-hmm. and who are good oral storytellers and have great stories that, when I meet them and talk to them in bars. But it's hard for me to have to generalize about that.
Mm-hmm. I'm just curious. It's interesting. Sometimes you read writers from Louisiana and kind of compare them to other writers from the South. And I was listening to Sheila Bosworth giving an interview years ago on NPR, and the interviewer asked her if there are any particular problems associated with being a writer from Louisiana. And she paused a moment and she said, Well, sometimes I get lost in the banana plants and I lose my story. And I knew kind of what she meant, that it's sort of so overwhelmingly sensuous sometimes in Louisiana that stories, they just end up staying on that sensual level rather than actually pushing forward into these great stories. So just wondered if you had some feeling.
Well, I do think, I was trying to think while you're talking, like students of mine who've lived here for a really long time, who may not have been from here but I do think like folk tales play a bigger role than, say, in Chicago.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So, there's more, just in terms of the richness of of the history of the people here and the, mm-hmm. and that, I guess I was familiar with that with my mother, having grown up in the South.
Mm-hmm.
But in Chicago, it's more, Chicago, for me at least, is kind of like it taps more into like urban legend,
mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
or things like that, which I'd played with in a previous book.
Right.
Here there's definitely a whole different, set of folklore,
mm-hmm.
than I've been exposed to,
right.
before.
I just think that would be fascinating as a teacher of writing to live in different places and encounter different kinds of students and their backgrounds. Obviously there are skills that you're working to impart to them, but you're also dealing with their natural backgrounds also and how they see the world.
Yeah, I think if I taught more undergrads, I would before coming here, I taught undergrads for 26 years,
mm-hmm.
but all in different places, and so I did get a better sense of the place, I think.
Yeah. Yeah.
But here, I get people from all over the country.
Yeah, I'm just this isn't another subject, but you know, I'm just thinking some people may, you know, look at the title of the book and you know, the subject matter of some of the stories and think, you know, how appropriate that they're putting this book out right now when we all have this sense of ominous dread. I can see people turning to this as kind of a comfort and a support group here.
It was fortuitous.
Yes.
Not in the way that I would have wanted, but
right.
But definitely, you know, I can't think of a more appropriate time to be releasing a book called The Fear of Everything.
That's right. Book clubs everywhere. The Fear of Everything. Now, get your copies. Well, it was certainly an incredible pleasure for me reading these stories, and I hope that many people listening will get an opportunity to read them as well. If you are tuning in, my guest has been Professor John McNally. He is the writer in residence here at UL Lafayette. The UL Press has published his book, The Fear of Everything, a collection of 9 short stories. It's actually out on September 1st, and you can find out more through the UL Press or just, as we all do, search online and find out more about it. And I do like the way that it seems like everybody in every story in here is always searching, Googling. It feels so familiar, looking stuff up. Well, John, thank you for your work here at the university and publishing these stories and sharing that with us. And we look forward to your future work, and we look forward to actually having you in our studios physically the next time, hopefully. So. But again, thank you. And the UL Press, they have a website, and you can, and if you happen to be on campus, you know, you can drop in Dupre Library, and they're in the library. Anything else we should know, John, about this book or future writings that you'd like us to be aware of?
I think that's it. Since I'm kind of staying in my house, I've been writing a lot, but I don't know what's going to happen.
What's going to happen to that writing?
It may just be the rantings of a lunatic at this point, but but I am writing.
Okay, well, we'll look forward to it in 10 years. I'll see what that's all about. Well, thank you so much, John. We really appreciate that.
Thank you. I really appreciate it.